On this episode of The Edible Valley, we're sitting down and talking with chef and author Joseph Forrest.
Welcome to The Edible Valley Podcast. I'm Blaine Prose.
And we would like you to join with us on our ongoing adventure exploring our Edible Valley. I am Jonathan Fraser.
I'd like to welcome Chef Joseph Forrest to the studio. Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you're the chef in residence at Innisfree Farm?
Yes, just up from Royston.
Right.
And so you've been away for the last little while, and you're just sort of getting back into the swing of the Comox Valley right now.
Yes, I was away for 4.5 months over the winters. I was chef in residence there last year.
Correct.
And spent 7 months living on the farm, on the property, in the yurt, which is a great space.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
And this winter I went to the foothills of the Colorado Rocky Mountains, where I helped a retreat center, a holistic retreat center, open up a farm-to-table culinary academy.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's really? It just launched a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
on April 2nd.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I did there was in keeping with what's really on my horizon right now, and that is real food. It really boils down to it. I spent the last 27 years pretty much what I call the industrial food, plugged into the industrial food complex.
Right.
And what that means to me is just basically working with a standard American diet for the most part. And the last 20 years was working as a caterer in the Vancouver film industry. And there were some things I was doing outside of that model or that paradigm that was more in keeping with what I'm doing now. So a couple of years ago, I came over to the Innisfree Farm at the invitation of Chen Chell. I came over on 4 different weekends from the city to see if it was a fit for me to move here. And it was. What they're doing there is really in keeping with where I want to go with my career now.
That's something we'd like to get into, is what are you exactly doing there? Like you're cooking there and you're...
I'm doing a number of things. I'm doing a number of things, Jonathan. I consider myself to be in sabbatical right now. And what that means to me is that I've taken time away from the food industry, for the most part working on the commercial side, to more or less reinvent my culinary career. So what I do there right now in the mornings is I prepare food for the interns. As you know, we have an internship program there that people come from different parts of the country. And this year we've got someone all the way up from North Carolina.
Wow. Yeah. And if people are interested in the internship, they can check out the website.
Yes, I'll bring that to their attention.
Yeah, we'll definitely have that on our blog site.
So. Okay, sure. So what the interns do is they learn from Thierry and Chanchel the mechanics of food from a vegetable perspective or from a soil scientist's perspective and also from a medical herbalist's perspective. Mm-hmm. So Thierry has them for some days of the week where they work directly with him learning how to farm organically, and other times of the week they work directly with Chanchel on the botanical or the medicinal side of the farm. The farm grows vegetables and it also grows herbs. Chanchel designs and manages the culinary and botanical medicine gardens, and Thierry manages develops and manages the vegetable gardens. Nice. And what I do is I come together and work with both elements.
Right. Hmm. Yeah, they have wonderful herbs. I was using a few at the restaurant over the years. So
awesome.
Yeah. I know some of that stuff. So.
Yeah. So what they're in the process of doing this year is they're moving in the direction of becoming a botanical garden. As a matter of fact, over the winter they became designated as a botanical garden.
Hmm.
And when I asked Chanchel what that means, she said, "Well, being a botanical garden requires you to do 3 things. First of all, you have to educate. Well, we're doing that already. Secondly, you have to be conservative in that you have to practice conservation. You have to grow as many food varieties of plants as possible,"
right,
which is what we're doing. And the third is that you have to be open to the public. And that's what they want to shift. We are open to the public right now for all of the public programs that we offer, but they want to expand more than just the people that are living in the valley. They want to be able to advertise nationally and even internationally, and have this be something, the farm be some place that people would actually come to as a destination, rather than just stumbling upon while they're here, but they would actually make plans to come and visit the garden.
Right.
So the gardens, the botanical gardens will have a focus of food and medicine. So some botanical gardens focus on orchids, others perhaps daffodils. And what we're going to be doing is food and medicine. That would be our specialty.
Wow, that's a unique blend.
Yeah, it is. And that's what I mean the Comox Valley, specifically at Innisfree Farm, to do is study food as medicine.
Right. Yeah, that's a growing trend, isn't it? People are starting to become more aware of, like, the general public's becoming more aware of the fact that food is more than just nutrition, or just more than fuel. It's nutrition. It can heal.
It definitely has that potential. It can make you sick, and it can make you well.
Yeah.
And of course, food is medicine. There's a focus on well-being on, just by virtue of that name. The food people do. There is a focus now more on real, what I call real food, whole food.
Mm-hmm.
People are waking up to the idea that processed food has been damaged, it's been stripped, it's been denaturized, it's been tampered with.
Yeah.
And as more people realize that food has the power to provide well-being, then people are becoming more educated.
Yeah.
And with that education, they go out into the marketplace and they make choices that are making a difference in how they eat, mm-hmm. and how they shop.
Yeah.
And consequently, how restaurants and growers and manufacturers are even producing food.
That's right. Yeah. You and I are thinking the same way along these lines. I've been really concerned about that for the last year and a half, and I've changed so much in my diet and my health. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't take long to notice a difference.
No, it doesn't. I lost weight really fast. My health improved just by eating real food and getting off the industrial system, basically.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I find that's one of the biggest challenges in the restaurant business right now is breaking away from some of that food that comes in. You know, like it's very easy for someone to hand you this pre-made sauce and that and go with it. But
yeah,
it's a lot more work to actually work with real food. So.
Yeah, it's true. And it also carries a premium.
Yes.
So restaurants are concerned about their bottom line.
That's right.
Restaurant guests are concerned about not paying an arm and a leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always a concerted effort to keep the prices down, and one of the ways that you do that is by bringing in food that doesn't cost as much to begin with.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, I know myself. I've pretty much eat at home. I don't really go out to eat very often because I'm not sure. I'm unsure of what the quality is going to be, if there's actually things on the menu that I really want to eat, and I can pick my own ingredients and I can eat as much as I want without it costing me an arm and a leg, because I tend to eat a fair amount. So,
right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say that you've lost a lot of weight and yet you eat a lot.
Oh yeah.
So that's a testament right there that you're onto something that works for your body.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's a key too, is that in all of this, is that I'm finding that what works for one person doesn't always work for another.
Yeah, it's an individual thing. I mean, yeah, absolutely. What works for one person doesn't. Some people can digest fat easier than others. Some people can handle lots of greens. Some people can't. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's all an individual thing.
Yeah, and so you've got to, over the years, I've learned to pay attention to what my body needs and tap into my body wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always experimenting with my food, with my diet. And I would say right now I'm about 90% where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And for now, I mean, that might change again in another 3 years or 5 years or 10 years.
Yeah.
But I'm actually finding my own groove with what works for me right now. And I'm when I stick to that, I thrive.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and you really do. Once you get well, you really notice the signals in your body when something's not quite right, and you can think back and realize what you did that maybe caused that issue.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. It's remarkable how resilient the body is to absorb the mistakes we make. But as we get stronger and more fortified by the food that we eat, I agree with you that it doesn't take much sleuthing if something goes wrong to pinpoint what you did that was out of line with who you are, and it's easier to reset the switch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And once you do get healthy, if you do eat something that's not what would be optimal food, it doesn't affect you as much as, like they say, a cheat day or a cheat meal or something. You can have a cheat meal and it doesn't really, me anyways, it doesn't really affect me too bad. If I eat like that constantly, I feel terrible. But if I do eat it once in a while, my body's resilient enough that it can absorb that and I can move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the word to use this is resilient, like you just said. The body has a remarkable power to rebound from the mistakes we throw at it.
Yeah.
If you give it the right food, the right, the clean water, the right amount of sunshine, fresh air, exercise.
Yeah.
It's got to, but that practice, the practice of living well that way requires getting out of the book and actually applying it. And that takes time to sort out your food trip.
Yeah, it does. It's really hard for people that are on the SAD, Standard American Diet, mm-hmm. to realize that you can change the way you eat. And the way they've been telling you to eat isn't necessarily the right way to eat, but it's hard for people to think that they can't just go to the grocery store and buy everything out of a box and be healthy.
So yeah.
It well, really does. You really have to change your whole mindset on how you're feeding yourself.
Yes, I agree. And I'd like to get back to the idea of real food or whole food or food as medicine, of what's going on at Innisfree Farm.
I was going to ask us what foods are you cooking there and how is it different from a lot of places?
Well, for one, it's organic.
Right.
And for another, I'm in control of what's going into the food. Like, so just like you, I stay away from restaurants for the most part now as well.
Right.
Only because I've worked in them myself and I know that they're working with their bottom line and they're going to look for not necessarily the cheapest food, but they're going to look for
value.
For value, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing is that I don't particularly like the oils that are being used in the mainstream diets.
Yes, I agree with that too.
And the vegetable oils, particularly the polyunsaturated oils, are really doing a lot of damage to the body, particularly
yeah. mm-hmm.
When they become rancid or if they become hydrogenated.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the food industry, in BC at least, their trans fats are no longer allowed. And so there's that thing that's going well for us. But for getting back to Innisfree Farm, I have more control over the foods that I prepare, and of course, Chady and Chanchel, they fully trust that I bring that to the table, and they're not looking over my shoulder. So
right.
So I'm managing the kitchen there. They just spent the winter upgrading their kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand, you're now doing at Atlas.
Exactly.
Yeah. And,
has to be done every so often.
Yeah. Well, they had when they bought the farmhouse, I think the farmhouse was built in the 40s. And so the kitchen was due for an overhaul.
Yeah.
And what they've done is they've commercialized it. And now what we've got is a commercial, professional, food safe kitchen that's got a gas stove and
it's
got lots of counter space. It's got it's actually a teaching kitchen as well.
Oh, wow.
So there's, before it's done, there'll be a tilt mirror that's put in, that's installed, so that mm-hmm. when whoever gives classes there on the presentation or the demonstration counter, the people out in the what is now our dining area, but it'll get that area gets converted into a classroom.
Oh, Oh, that's wonderful.
For people to sit. We've got the capacity for about 20, 25 people there. So the mirror will come in handy when we've got a full room.
For sure.
Yeah, that's a good size.
Yeah, it is. It's a nice space. And it's nice and open. It's clean. It's bright.
Mm-hmm.
And but they've basically given me the go-ahead to just completely take over the kitchen and make it my domain. And just off the kitchen, there's a large room that has been converted into a pantry, so I have all my dry goods in there. We've also got a double door refrigerator in there now, so it's really convenient. I've also got an office in there that where I produce the
having a mic stand issue.
So there's a pantry there. I've got an office there, and it's a great space to be in. And so some of the foods that I'm working with I'm very mindful of our protein intake. I'm very mindful of the amounts and the kinds of carbohydrates that we eat. And
yeah.
Of course, I mentioned earlier about the fats.
Yeah.
So working more with moving towards cooking with coconut oil.
Yeah.
Specifically because it is saturated.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of nutritional value in coconut oil that's being discovered. It got a bad rap by the oil industry a number of years ago. They wanted to corner the market, and they did.
Yeah.
But in the process, coconut oil got demonized. But it's becoming more and more in favor with the general public. And so I'm moving in the direction of using that for cooking.
Great.
And extra virgin olive oil. Mm-hmm. As well, but those are pretty much the only two oils that I use.
Right.
We eat a lot of farm eggs because we've got about 30 hens, 30 okay. laying hens.
So yeah.
We eat eggs probably a couple times a week.
Yeah.
Some seafood as well, some fish and seafood. I would like to eat a little bit more animal product personally, but that's not happening right now.
Right.
On the farm, Chanchelle was a vegetarian for 22 years, 18 years of that she was vegan. So she's moved away from that and now is moved more towards the paleo diet, but has not moved beyond eating fish right now.
Right.
So it's her home, and so she would like that to be.
I find a lot of vegans or vegetarians still have that issue that if changing their diet and accepting, you know, better quality of meats and stuff like that, and local and grass-fed. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Just accepting those items.
Yeah, especially if they've been that for a long term. But one of the things that she noticed is that when she started eating fish again, some of the symptoms that weren't really evident as symptoms, like full-blown, they disappeared. And so that was confirmation for her that she had made the right choice in starting to include animal protein back in her diet.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So yeah, the Innisfree Farm is a great place to be, to study. I prepare lunch in the mornings for whoever's on property, and that would include the Chady and Chanchelle, myself, the interns. Sometimes we have guests. We have an office manager, dispensary manager that joins us most days. And in the afternoon, I pretty much have the option of doing a number of things. One thing that I'm doing at the farm is producing a cookbook for them.
Oh, wow.
So using their produce primarily, and we're breaking it out into seasons. So right now I'm working on the spring, what's available in the springtime. And I've got a list of foods and a list of recipes that I want to develop and generate.
Yeah.
So I started that last year, and this year I hope to complete the recipe testing, and then over the winter we'll fine tune the writing and the narrative or the methodology, and write a head note for each recipe,
mm-hmm.
pointing to some of the historical factors or some of the nutritional and medicinal factors of the food.
Great.
So it's amazing how much work it is to put a book together. So
yeah, it is.
I've attempted many a times, and I can do a couple recipes and then I lose my will.
Yeah.
Well, two here and two there add up.
Yes.
So don't give up on it.
Yeah. No, I'm slowly working away. We have the island inspiration, which I got eight or nine recipes in. Not that they were properly tested or done correctly, but they did get in there. So it's always a challenge. I find it interesting.
It is. And I think one of the biggest challenges is the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done two other books?
I've done two cookbooks. Well, actually, my writing history started in 1995 when I co-wrote a vegetarian cookbook with a registered dietitian in Vancouver. Her name is Vicenta Molina. And we launched the book in 1996, and it became an instant bestseller in Canada.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great. It was good to be on national tour and get a feel for what that's like and be interviewed by lots of radio stations and some TV spots. And we had a good run in Canada with the book. And then 2 years later, it was released in the United States.
Mm.
And as most product cycles and a lot of books go, it had a life cycle that went up and then came down. And the book eventually went out of print. And 2 years ago, we were asked by a Canadian publisher if we'd like to revise it, which we did, and it came out in October of 2011.
Oh, yeah.
And then last year, a year ago this month, actually, it came out in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
So, but I'm kind of breaking ranks with that topic right now, and what I mean by that is I've moved more towards the Paleolithic diet
mm-hmm.
in terms of understanding, and when I practice that, I feel the best.
Yep.
But it's very important that if one is going to move in that direction, that they eat clean meat.
That's right.
You can't follow a Paleolithic diet and eat confined animals at the same time.
No,
it doesn't work. And I think that's a misconception in the public's mind.
Yeah,
a lot of the information that I've seen about the Paleolithic diet talks about eating meat, but they don't actually make that distinction.
That's right. Yeah, sometimes they say if you have to eat grocery store meat to eat very lean meat because a lot of the toxins are in the fats, not in the actual muscle itself.
Yes. They concentrate in the fat.
Yeah. But I don't buy meat at the grocery store at all, and I haven't for almost a year now. So.
Yeah.
Well, there's so many great farms around this area that you can go to.
Yeah. It's true.
And get some nice organic meats.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Island Bison is an example. Great example of that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's one of my new things now that I'm really concerned about is what my food is eating for its food.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, you know, you don't really know, even though it's not in a confined feeding operation, you still don't really know exactly what's going on. So that's something that I've become concerned about. And I hunt, so I'm able to get free-range meat, but anything else, it's a lot of research.
It is. And that's the thing with food in general is you mentioned earlier that you don't eat out in restaurants much anymore. And same with me. And it's because I have more control over what's going into my diet.
That's right. Yeah.
And it does take research. It does take time. If you're going to use food as medicine, you're going to have to develop a new relationship with it. And that's going to take time.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't happen overnight. That's for sure. It took me probably 3 or 4 months before I was really comfortable with the whole concept of not just eating from the grocery store. And then I had to start sourcing all this stuff. And so, I mean, it's a learning process that continues still today.
That's right.
It evolves and I'm changing my ideas on things and stuff. So
Yeah. It's a question of fine tuning.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I'd like to get back to this farm-to-table school that I helped launch in Colorado.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah, one of the things that I did while I was there was get the kitchen off of GMO products. And it really helped me see, well, while I was there, I really got a glimpse into how insidious those products are in our diet. The idea that soy oil and canola oil and high fructose corn syrup is in so much food that we purchase.
Yes.
And so we got the Culinary Academy off of that. And even though I did mention earlier that the Culinary Academy just launched last week or 2 weeks ago, but prior to that, and even now, the Culinary Academy is coming out of a retreat and conference business that has been operational since the early 90s. So there's a, and it's also the home of an intentional community. an intentional spiritual community. And so there's a community of about 60 or 70 people there that have been living there for a number of years, and they're the happy recipients of the retreat and conference business. So the kitchen produces food for the conference business, but they also, the community members get to eat there as well.
Mm.
So they've had food service operation for a number of years. Since they had that infrastructure in place, it was really easy. It was easier for them to set up a school. When I went in there, they asked me to make some recommendations. And the first thing that I did was suggest that they hire a professional chef, which they did. Prior to that, they had one of the community members that had just learned by working up through the ranks. But but she was limited in terms of her, because she wasn't professionally trained, there was a limit in terms of what she could envision the school might be. So they by bringing in the professional chef, they were able to raise the notch on a number of fronts. And the second recommendation that I made was get off the GMO products, mm-hmm. which they did. And it took a lot of time for them to work through what foods they were going to buy. They were so used to ordering certain lines of food product. And now it's like, okay, if I can't have all of that, what am I going to replace it with? And the non-GMO products are not as readily available. Just like gluten-free at one time was really hard to get. Now
that's, right.
that's growing. And so the choices are easier to make on that front. And it's the same with GMOs, the genetically modified organism, because so much food now is what I'll call contaminated with those organisms. There's a lot of them go into processed foods.
Yeah.
And not processed foods in terms of junk food, but even processed foods like, Jonathan, you were saying earlier about like bringing in a ready-made sauce or something like that.
Right.
So just a simple thing like a mayonnaise, for instance.
Just to preserve it and,
yeah.
and get that shelf life out of it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And, well, that's not so much what GMOs are for, but not so much a question of preservation, but there's so much of the product, so much of those oils, for instance, are in so many products.
Right.
So that's I helped them research some of what they were going to start ordering. I also helped them get more in touch with the local food, and that's really the point I want to make on this is that our research, if we're really keen on cooking for ourselves, or even not cooking for ourselves, we ought to get familiar with who's growing the food or who's manufacturing the food, so that we can create these trusting relationships in our food supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and make educated choices instead of just grabbing whatever because you're busy. Your life's busy, and you know, it doesn't really matter. But it does matter. It matters.
It does
so much.
It does.
You look at the rates of obesity and all the diseases and autoimmune diseases, and most of that's all contributed directly to our diets. So
yeah, well, I must admit that I've been quite excited lately, because the new challenge in restaurants for myself, being a chef, is that our customers are realizing this, mm-hmm. and definitely in this area, they're well educated.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're coming in and they're asking the questions of where did this come from. Who is the producer of this?
Yeah,
and
that's
now
great.
And so for me, all of a sudden, I have to look back and realize I have to know where all my product comes from and know a bit of the history behind it. So it's definitely challenging me, but I find it enjoyable because it's like it's opening my eye up to, well, what is this and why am I using it? Not just because this is what the customer wants, but it's why am I choosing this product over another? So. And definitely the GMO debate is great now because I think it's a whole new challenge of the food system.
Mm-hmm.
Just to find out what is being put in our food and you know, maybe simple is better.
I think In the long run it's going to boil down to that because if you're going to spend time in the kitchen looking after your health and looking after the health of your family and children and friends, then it's you're not going to be able to spend 3 or 4 hours every day. I have that luxury right now where I am. I don't have to take that much time, but I take it sometimes because I enjoy cooking, first of all. And secondly, I like doing something today that is going to benefit my menu tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And or even in 2-3 days' time. Like fermentation, we were talking about that before we went on air.
Right. Yeah.
Fermentation isn't something that happens overnight.
No.
You got to plan it. You've got to monitor it. You've got to prepare for it. You've got to do something with it once the final product is done.
Yeah.
Transfer it to smaller jars, perhaps.
Have the fridge space to store it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Cellar space.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that's an example of planning ahead and taking it into your own hands.
Yeah, it's totally about planning ahead and preserving things when they're available, like in season, in the summertime, putting away like canning or drying product that's available locally that you can't get in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I know I did a lot of that last year, and I'm still reaping the benefits of that now.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah, and that's time-consuming. So that getting back to the cookbook that I'm creating for the farm, we're doing seasonal things. And so even right now, even though it's springtime and things are just coming up, just yesterday, for instance, I made a stinging nettle and horsetail vinegar.
Oh, nice.
And that'll be ready in about 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
maybe a bit longer. But that's something that is taking advantage of what I've got now at its peak.
Right.
And I'll be able to use that through the winter.
Yeah.
When that's not available. And it will provide me with all of the minerals and the silica, for instance, that's in the horsetail. I made a stinging nettle stock last week and then subsequently a soup. And I got both Chady and Chanchel to taste it. And I was trying to discern the aftertaste that I was experiencing with Chanchel. I was asking her about it. And she said, "What were you tasting there? Is metallic?" She said, "Stinging nettles are very metallic." She said, "That's how full of minerals they are that it actually leaves a metallic taste in the mouth."
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be extracted from that into the vinegar, and I'll be able to use that for salad dressings or even therapeutically.
Right. Yeah, I know. I've heard that people say kale is a superfood, but stinging nettles blow kale out of the water as far as their mineral content, nutritional content.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I picked a good bag of them last week, and I dehydrated a bunch of them, so they're in my stores for tea for the winter when you start feeling under the weather.
Yeah.
You get a good shot of all that good stuff.
That's right.
So.
Awesome. So, yeah, I getting back to local food, it's really a question of who's doing what and how are they doing it and developing these relationships that not only support your own health but support the health of the people that are producing it. Let's face it, these are small scale operations for the most part.
Yeah.
And they need the support of the people.
Yeah.
And that's the key to this movement, really, is stay local.
Mm-hmm.
and develop these relationships and develop the community around that so that we can trust who's growing the food and how it's being made.
Yeah. And then so they can keep their doors open.
Yes.
So they can keep doing it.
Yeah. That's right.
For sure.
Farming is not necessarily a lucrative endeavor.
It's a rewarding one, though.
Yeah, yes. It is. Yeah. But you still need money to pay the bills. And
that's true.
And if they don't have customers, it's pretty hard to stay in business. So
yeah, yeah. So I'm just going to invite all the viewers to support the local farmers.
Absolutely. That's something we've been promoting all along with this is
just getting out there. I mean, when we started, you were a little shy about going out to the farmer's market. You were totally intimidated by, approaching the vendors and how things work there. And I think after a week or two, you've blown me by, you knew more people down at the market than I did. Like, oh yeah, we got to go get this over here.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's just a matter of getting out there and jumping in and meeting the people out there. So,
yeah.
And more people are jumping on board.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, the more people get educated, the more they dig.
Yeah.
And the deeper they dig, the more they're finding out about how insidious and how dangerous and how much tampering the industrial food complex has been subjected to.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been every, at least once a week, twice a week, I get somebody asking me about diet. Just they sort of start hinting at stuff, so I bring something up, and then it turns into a conversation. Always ends up, what do you eat then? I eat really good. I eat all sorts of stuff. Like, so, yeah, it's, and people just, it's, you see them just puzzled, like, how can you possibly do this? But no, it's, you just have to try. And
yeah.
And yeah. Once you start feeling better, you'll be amazed and you won't be able to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, so, that's the key right there. And like yeah. you said, it's like when you, once you do make the mistake, it's you, the, you can go a week or two without, or even longer without a certain kind of food that you used to have on a regular basis mm-hmm. and then think nothing of it to have it again. And that's when you really get the test
yeah.
of how ill suited it is for you.
Yeah.
Because you get an immediate reaction.
Yeah.
What I mean by immediate is like a 24-hour space in which to, for it to settle into your stomach and like, whoa, you know, that doesn't sit as well as it used to.
That's right.
And so that's how we make the change.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this, with fermenting, you're trying to learn some things about this stuff. Is something sort of new to you?
Well, let's see, what's new on the fermenting? Well, I'm starting off with sauerkraut. I think that's really, really easy and basic for people.
Yeah.
And it's easy to put together. I'm currently eating one batch. I've got two more that are on the go. I'm gonna experiment with different lengths of time mm-hmm. that they get fermented for. I'm also looking at working with the amount of salt.
Yeah.
Working with whey a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I've been getting some whey from the Tree Island yogurt perfect. Makers.
Yeah.
And working with that. Working with whey a lot more. Just for lunch today, for instance, I made a walnut Irish soda bread using whey to soak the spelt flakes overnight instead of buttermilk.
Okay.
And so the acidity of the whey activated the soda, the baking soda, and it added more protein mm-hmm. than buttermilk would have.
Right.
And so. So I'm working with whey as a starter to see how far it can push the reduction of salt.
Right.
Now I know that salt is used in fermentation to keep down the bacteria that could possibly turn into undesirable amounts.
Right. Yeah.
So it keeps that bacterial population down as it so that the beneficial bacteria actually increase and get a better head start.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'm not sure how much I can push the envelope on how low I should keep the salt.
Yeah.
I know that some people are doing fermentation that aren't using salt at all, and they're not using whey either because they might be vegan.
Right.
So I think it's a question of experimenting with different batches.
Yeah, I think so.
And with smaller batches so that you don't end up with like 5 gallons of something that yeah. you don't like.
5 gallons
or can't store.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the best part about food is just the experimenting and playing with it.
Yeah.
And just creating something a little bit different than,
yeah.
and trying to find that perfect blend out there.
Mm-hmm. That's what I always tell people. They ask a question about something. So just try it. You know, I think people are afraid to experiment because they don't want to fail at something. So just try it and see what happens.
Yeah.
It's an adventure. Like, just go for it.
And someone who's done fairly well in my career, the failures I've had have been astonishing. You yeah. can ask my wife some of the meals I've made for her, and she's been like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've made a few of those myself.
Yeah.
So I've also tried working with kvass. Mm-hmm. The fermented beets,
right?
Beet mixture. Once again, I thought that it was a bit too salty, mm-hmm. so I'm going to use that for the basis of a borscht.
Okay, yeah.
So I'll turn that fermented beverage into a soup,
right?
And probably a raw soup, so that I don't heat, so I don't have to pasteurize that, or kill the bacteria that's developed,
right
there. I'm also right now working with kombucha.
Mm-hmm.
There's one of the interns, Ryan on the farm right now has been experimenting with kombucha as well. And in fact, we just had today a sample of a beverage that he that he made. It was, I think he said it was, well, it was kombucha as the base, and then he added to that a ginger, pineapple, and dandelion root.
Interesting blend.
Yeah, yeah. So once again, food as medicine.
Yeah.
And you've got a beverage that was nicely carbonated.
Yeah.
That takes the place of the sodas that people are can easily reach for and consume in 5 minutes or so. So you've got this, a carbonated beverage that is actually beneficial to your gut flora, as opposed to, you know, kicking your pancreas out of whack because of the amount of sugar.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've been doing kombucha since probably September, I think, when we had Tara Grant in
Tara
the studio.
Tara Grant, I was just thinking about her on there. So
she brought me a SCOBY, and
in
I
the
had
studio
no idea
there,
what to do.
And you're like, I don't know what to do with this. I got a good laugh out of it, but now you're hooked on it.
Yeah, I make it constantly. I usually have two batches going at a time, so I have two different vessels.
And I think you've got half a dozen people going on it as well.
Yeah, I keep spreading it around and getting people interested in it, because I think fermented food's so important.
It is. It is. So much of the food that we've consumed over the course of our life typically does a lot of damage to our intestinal flora, and therefore we don't. As a consequence, we don't have the immune system.
That's right.
That we could have, and so these fermented products is a way of getting the lactobacillus into the gut and creating a healthy population of that to ward off the pathogens that more and more we're being exposed to.
Yeah, I know, like, almost everybody I've talked to have said, oh man, that flu this winter, you know, it was so bad and I didn't even get a sniffle or anything, but I'm constantly eating lactobacillus and it's my immune system's super strong from it.
Yeah.
I mean, you think that in the olden days people would eat stuff that had bacteria on it, and it was constantly, you know, your hands were dirty and your food was a little bit dirty and it was just constantly going in. But now everything's so sanitary that you don't get any of that when you're eating your food.
We kill the good stuff and the bad stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You kill it all.
So like taking antibiotics, right? As soon as you pasteurize it, you're basically killing everything.
Yeah.
And I've heard that this ultra pasteurized milk that is available now on the market, that it won't even hold a culture to grow yogurt.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't support life that way, I mean, what's it doing inside your body?
Yeah,
exactly.
And yeah, raw milk is a whole nother story, and I'm really interested in raw milk, and I don't know anybody that has it, but I sure would like to get a hold of some and try it.
Yeah.
That would be a whole nother show, I think. Just talk about whole milk.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely something that's starting to come up. And
it is. It is. And we've got, interestingly enough, the Tree Island folk are making their yogurt with raw milk. But they had to jump through a lot of hoops in order to get that passed and approved and whatnot. And apparently when the milk is brought to them, because it's raw, it's actually considered and treated as a hazardous material.
Oh, jeez.
So for instance, if there happened to be a spill, a raw milk spill on the highway, for instance, they would have to treat it as a hazardous material and bring in the folks in all their bio suits with the masks and fully clothed and just to mop it up.
That's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, but it's a testament to where we've come, and it's also, I think there's some politics at play in that.
There's a lot of politics at
play in that. And there are the forces that own the market, that have cornered the market. They're making it harder for people to grow their own food, to manufacture their own food. In the ways that you and I are talking about today.
Yes.
Right? It's like there's all these regulations that have to be enforced and enacted and played by. That if you have to be really serious and have a passion for your product or for your food in order to push through that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's discouraging people, but luckily there's people amongst us that have the fortitude to say, I believe in this, and I'm going to make it available for myself and others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the movement seems to be growing quite rapidly. They're starting to want their freedom of choice back as far as what they consume and what they're allowed to do with their own,
well, it's just their amazing own property. What we've learned about, how food culture has changed in, say, the last 10 years, or 20 years, 30 years, the old food pyramid is, if you look back at it, it's almost a joke to think that that's how people everyone should eat those items of food, right? It doesn't work for everyone. It's not set right. It was one guy's idea,
mm-hmm,
who said this is how we should all eat, but it was never really researched.
No.
And so now we're kind of, all of a sudden, a lot of people are just getting that eye-opening. I know myself personally, just realizing and taking that question of, where is my food coming from? And thinking about, just as a kid, going on the beaches and picking oysters straight, mm-hmm, off the beaches, and clams, and catching salmon out there and smoking salmon. That was just something I did. But, mm-hmm, for my daughter, it's not something that she's accustomed to or even, knows how to do it.
Yeah,
I'm trying to teach her, but
yeah,
the culture's not there.
Yeah,
or it's starting to come back. There's almost like a gap that's kind of missed that whole part of growing up, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I'm really trying to do with my daughter, is bring those values to her and say, this is what we do. We're going to go pick oysters. We're going to butcher a deer. We're going to go pick nettles. I involve her in that process so that she understands what it's all about.
Yeah, well, what you're doing there too, not just giving her the understanding, but you're bringing her out into nature. And if she can connect with nature, that will serve her for the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's been picking mushrooms with me since she was 5 years old. And I've always brought her along, so
nice,
and encouraged it.
Yeah.
So it's really important.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, you were talking about the changes that we've seen in the last 20, 30 years. The food industry as a whole has had more change in the last 50 years than any other time in its history.
That's true.
And probably the biggest change that is occurring today is the infiltration of GMO, mm-hmm, products, genetically modified organisms. It's scary, actually, in terms of how vast that movement has become, how so many people have bought into it, farmers, growers,
mm-hmm,
but they're finding that there's challenges in that too. They're slowly discovering that, or not so slowly in some cases, that the benefits that were promised them by the seed companies they were there initially, but now they're developing super weeds and requiring more than just one passing of pesticides and herbicides.
Herbicide, yeah.
And I think that more and more people need to be educated on that front alone, because,
mm-hmm,
there's a corporate takeover actually that's taking place right now with Monsanto at the helm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And just to think how much money they're throwing at it to try and protect themselves. To try and stop people from saying, wait, there may be a problem with us putting this chemical on our plants or manipulating what we're growing that maybe we should look at a little closer. And they're like, don't worry about it. And they're trying to stop it, stop people from having the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are. Or they're lying about the discussion. This Proposition 37 in California, for instance, there was one advertisement that basically stated that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, had approved, and they have, but apparently the FDA doesn't allow people to use their name in advertising, and so the non-supporter, the non-GMO supporters, caught wind of that, and there'll be a lawsuit, and Monsanto will be fined, but they just chalk that up as a cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they know they're breaking the law at the time, but they know they'll pay for that, but it just becomes an expense to them.
Yeah, that's awful.
It is. It is. So we need more education on that front. And that's where TAD, one of the owners of Innisfree Farm, is doing such a brilliant job.
Mm-hmm.
He recently had a editorial opinion printed in the Echo. I think it was last Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And he recently spoke in Vancouver. He spoke this past weekend at the rally in Souk, where an initiative of an island-wide initiative was approved for the island to be a GMO-free zone.
Right.
Now, that doesn't necessarily have teeth, because it's the federal government that actually legislates and regulates the agricultural policies across the land.
Right.
But what it does is that it once again, going back to education, it gets people in the know, and that information comes out in the press, and people start paying attention. It's like, okay, well, what are these things? And so once again, the sleuthing comes out, people dig a little deeper, and then they make their own choices.
Mm-hmm.
But TAD is doing a great job. He's getting some international attention, actually, in his position.
Just around this valley, I've had separate discussions about his conversations that he's had with people, like just separate entities just coming to me and talking about his discussion about GMOs and that. And it's quite interesting that it's taking effect on people.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're starting to question a lot of things that they took for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's some farmers in this valley that are not too happy about it.
Yes, I know. I know. Yeah.
Not naming any names, but there definitely is. There's some opposition to his ideal. So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's to be expected. I mean, they bought in, and obviously something's working for them to some degree.
Yeah.
Maybe they haven't researched it enough. But the film Genetic Roulette, for instance, I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a good documentary on that covers a wide range of research.
Oh yeah.
And one of the things in watching that film, one of the things that I saw or realized for the first time is that there's actually two ways that Monsanto is modifying the plant cells, and one of them is to make them resistant to their Roundup herbicide, but the other one is that they're actually splicing a gene into the plant so that the plant starts to make its own insecticide.
Right.
And how that works is that the insects nibble away at the plant, and the insecticide is systemic. It's not just on the surface as an insecticide sprayed on it would be.
Right.
But the whole plant
Every
develops.
Every cell has it.
Exactly. So as the plant, what happens when the plant is chewed on by an insect? Its gut splits open or bursts open, and one of the things that has been documented is that since the GMOs have been on the market since 1996, there's a direct correlation in the amount of as its introduction or as its use is introduced into the food system, there is a direct correlation in terms of the increase of gastrointestinal problems that people are having.
Mm.
And that was mentioned in the film,
right.
Genetic Roulette. And I had an interesting conversation with someone at Sunrise Ranch, where I just spent the winter with this, launching the Culinary Academy. I was talking to a fellow that said that when he was eating food at the ranch, his stomach, which ordinarily when he's eating at home, which is off ranch, he says, when I eat at home, I get the stomach problems that develop, and it really impacts my sleep at night.
Mm.
When I'm here on the ranch, he said that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And so I brought to his attention what I just shared about the this insecticide in the plants. And I can't say that that's what was going on for him, but because I was exposed to that information, I was able to say, aha, I wonder if this is a case wherein or whereby the GMO is impacting someone right before my eyes here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I just chalk that up. I chalk that up as, okay, I'm doing the right thing here by staying away from them.
Yeah. And that's the thing that people are not really understanding with gluten-free is that you may be having an aversion to wheat, but then when you buy something that's gluten-free, it's probably made with GMO corn. So it's not necessarily going to fix your problem that you're having with your celiac sort of gluten issues.
Or your gastrointestinal issue.
Yeah. So it's, unless, yeah, I think it's just best to stay away from all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's, there's just a never ending line of problems that can arise from it.
For sure.
So.
Well, I think we've had a great discussion here. Thank you very much for joining us.
Joseph and I can probably talk for hours and hours
and hours.
I imagine
you guys just go off. So yeah. No, it's been great having you here. Yeah. And maybe we'll have you back at the end of the summer after you've done a few things and we can talk about some of that.
Yeah.
I think there's some.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'm very interested in what's going on there. So,
well, Innisfree Farm is a place that's on the map now, and especially with Chady's influence in the community on the GMO front. But we also have a lot of public workshops there. Chanchelle and I are doing some food as medicine workshops this summer. She has botanical herb programs that she offers. We have a movie and dinner every second and fourth Thursday of the month that people are invited to. I prepare dinner that night, and then we sit down, and it's an opportunity to build community, and then we watch a movie together. And the movies are generally on the lines of what we've been talking about for the last hour.
Right.
So something that is politically hot, or something that is food for thought.
Right.
Or something that this year I think he's going to throw in a few movies that are just pure entertainment, food movies for entertainment.
Okay.
Wonderful.
But we're an education center. We're more than just a farm, a CSA program.
Right.
And I do believe there's still room for people to come on board to buy CSA shares.
Okay.
So we're more than just a vegetable farm, though. We're an education center. So if people want to check us out, they're innisfreefarm.org. And hope to see you there.
Yeah. Great.
Definitely just drop by, I think. Just drive by and see what's going on the farm.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, it's really exploding right now with this warm weather that we're getting.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Wonderful. Yeah. All right, Joseph, thanks for coming in studio. It was a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, indeed.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right, thanks for listening to the Edible Valley Podcast. We gratefully accept donations to help with the operating costs of the podcast or local ingredients to create new dishes in the Edible Valley Test Kitchen. Check out our website, ediblevalley.com. Like us on Facebook and follow our Twitter feed at Edible Valley. Email us with your comments or guests you would like to hear on the show. Don't hesitate to send along your cooking questions for John to answer on the show or to pick our brain on other local food information. Edible Valley at gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, keep it local.